Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Healthy eating should be a way of life and not an aberration. That, in a nutshell, is the philosophy of Nancy Easton and her team at Wellness in the Schools, the nonprofit she founded in 2005 and happens to be my guest today. As executive director, Nancy has helped WITS grow from 3 New York City public schools to more than 70, impacting some 40,000 students. Nancy was named a Food Revolution hero by acclaimed chef and food activist Jamie Oliver. Ann Cooper, also known as the Renegade Lunch Lady, named Nancy a lunchbox hero for her dedication to reforming school lunches. A lifelong athlete, eating healthy is a piece of cake for Nancy. She has several marathons and triathlons under her belt, including an Ironman distance triathlon. In 2003, she became a founding board member of Girls on the Run Manhattan, a nonprofit that uses the power of running to change the way girls see themselves. Nancy, who graduated from Princeton, got her master's from Manhattan's Bank Street College of Education and an administration and supervision certification from City College and Fordham University. She worked for the New York City Department of Ed for more than 15 years as a teacher mentor, and a school leader. Nancy works with a committed team of professionals, including renowned, respected executive chef Bill Telepan, who's been part of the WITS staff since 2008. His restaurant, Telepan, has been a fixture on Manhattan's Upper West Side since 2005. I've eaten there, and the food is fabulous. So let's meet mover and shaker Nancy Easton. Welcome, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. That was a wonderful introduction. Thank you.
But like I tell my guests, I don't make it up. I get the information from you.
But it comes with that great, strong voice.
Well, there you go.
I'm going to think about that as I'm speaking today.
So talk to me about your life as an athlete.
Well, I was raised in Florida, where many kids are, it's very easy to be an athlete because you're running around outside and playing
outside all the time, all day long.
Mm-hmm. But I also was raised with a very, my mother was called Nature Lady by the kids in the neighborhood, so you can kind of get a sense of what we were doing. We were in a suburb of Miami, and we had chickens and with their eggs.
Oh, my.
Yeah, until the possum ate them. So, you know, the possum were coming, so we decided to build a chicken coop to protect
them.
It's
like the Russians are coming. The Russians are coming.
Uh-huh. So, unfortunately, the possum got in and the chicken couldn't get out. So they're better off in the garage where we did keep them originally. My mom, you know, the bake sales at the soccer games and stuff, she decided to sell grapefruit and oranges. So
did she embarrass you?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. You kidding? Oh, and she brought out, you know, they used to have those bad hot dog machines. She brought out a grill to actually grill hot dogs and hamburgers. That was actually a time when I was a little bit proud because everybody loved them. And they all kept coming back for the hot dogs and hamburgers. And they sold many more than.
So she was a ballsy broad, wasn't she?
Totally. She's told me all my life that she really didn't have the opportunities to do the kind of fitness that I did. But she was very, very forward thinking, like crazy lady forward thinking on the food front. Mm-hmm. Everybody was going to TV dinners and she was giving me Carob brownies. So she and wheat bread. I mean, everyone was doing the white bread. So she was way ahead in the food and I didn't really think about it because it really embarrassed me. Like
I was going to say, did you have friends come
over? No one wanted to trade lunch with me. Friends did not come over. I would go to Dania Johnson's house to eat Oreos on her mother's king size bed.
And rightly so.
Mm-hmm. So it you know, the food thing I was not happy about, but I just you went with it because that's what we were fed.
It's either that or I'm not eating.
Exactly. But the fitness piece, you know, they threw us into sports. There were 4 kids. They threw us into sports from the very beginning, probably just to keep us busy. And it's what kids did there. So certainly in Florida, and it was a big state for soccer. And we would go to all the states and all that kind of stuff. So I took to that quite naturally very young. And then I just continued to excel, I guess, in sports and ended up getting recruited in college for soccer to several colleges. And
so you played?
I played. Uh-huh.
You started?
I did.
Did you ever think that that would be a career for you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing is I also was a runner. And what happened was a soccer coach walked down the hall to the running because you have your little resume. And he says, is this a good time? And the running coach called me as well. And in the state of Florida at the time, I wasn't like the state champion in running, but I was decent, and it was a pretty strong state. So anyway, I ended up running and doing better at that in college. I'd love sports, and I did.
But it
have
was a natural
talent.
Act for you, and it's also your foundation. and being fit and eating healthy, your mother notwithstanding, which obviously she put that seed in your brain, but you continue to do that. I mean, you're not going to be a runner and eat McDonald's.
And I'm actually glad you brought this up, because often WITS is known, Wellness in the Schools is known mostly for the food program, the Cook for Kids program, because it's maybe trendy. There are many chefs in New York and people hear about that all the time. And people don't talk as much about the coach program, which is something that we want to change and promote. And that's a little bit of more my background. So, so thank you. I'm glad
well,
you brought
we'll get
that up.
There.
Our team will be pleased.
But I want to move into that direction. Okay. So you go to college. Did you think you were going to major in education, or did you know what it was that you were going to do back then? I mean, it all seemed like a very natural progression for you.
You know, now that I'm just turned 50 and look back at my life, I think, God, it actually all kind of worked out the way it was supposed to. Back then, I feel I had this wonderful blessing of just being following what I love and doing that and all sort of working out. And it's certainly the advice that I give my kids today and give young people always is to really follow what you love and it'll come together. Mm-hmm. And in my case, it happened too. I'm like, wow, that actually makes sense, because that's how I was fed as a kid and I did sports. But I didn't really pull all of that. I did not at all pull all of that together until I got older, really.
Mm-hmm. So what did you think you were going to do?
What did I
want to
do
up?
When I grew up? I actually did want to be a teacher. But that could be because that's what a lot of women wanted to do.
Sure.
Sounding so old. But
no, but it's true.
Yeah, that was a career for women.
And a very respectable one and an important one.
And I actually played school all the time with kids and younger siblings. And I loved to babysit. I was a camp counselor. So that also I loved and came naturally. So, yeah, I wanted to be a teacher. And I did become a teacher.
And how'd you wind up here in New York?
My parents are both from Pittsburgh, so Florida was not like a natural place for them. And when I was little, my mom and I would take trips up to New York, the big trip to New York. We'd see theater, we'd go to a restaurant, we'd walk the city. And so I always loved New York City. And I had an aunt, her sister, who lived in New York, and she was so cool. You know, the cooler, more progressive family members, I guess, lived in New York.
Of course.
And we, you know, Floridians, uncool and unsophisticated, thought it was great to come up here and be cold. And I, you know, I grew up in a somewhat small town, and now it's a fancy, Miami's fancy. When I was growing up, I grew up in a suburb of Miami. It was not on the cover of any magazine. When I got to college, I'm like, look, that's my town on the cover with all these pretty pictures and this beautiful blue sky. But growing up, you didn't really know beyond Tallahassee. I applied to University of Georgia. University of Virginia was a big school to apply to. But through soccer, a coach from Dartmouth saw me play, and he started to recruit me. And through that, we were like, oh, maybe there are other schools outside of the state of Florida and Georgia and Virginia that I could potentially apply to.
Did Princeton recruit you for sports?
So I guess, yes. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, Princeton did as well. So once the Dartmouth coach saw me, then the Princeton coach saw me and kind of went from there. And so in the end, it was either these Southern schools or the decision between Dartmouth and Princeton. This I do remember. I remember being on the phone, again, it sounds so small town Florida, with the Dartmouth coach saying, I can't go there. It's too cold.
I was just going to say that. I bet you thought it was just too cold.
It was too cold. And so Princeton seemed a little bit warmer.
Yeah.
And it was an
it's
hour.
In southern Jersey.
Right. We looked at the map and it was an hour from my Aunt Nancy, who was living in New York. So she'd be there for me. So that's kind of how I ended up at Princeton. I never looked back. I moved to Japan after college and went back to Miami to kind of regroup before I came back to New York. But I always once I went to Princeton, I always thought I'd be up here. I never looked back.
Well, the fact of the matter is you can go back worlds. You can live this sophisticated lifestyle. Not that it's not sophisticated in Miami, but you can go down and you can chill out. No pun intended.
My father does wonder why my taxes are so high. But,
well,
you know,
don't we all? Don't we all? If you're just joining us, my guest today is Nancy Easton, who happens to be the founder of the nonprofit called Wellness in the Schools. So you teach for a while, and then what happens to you?
So what happened was, people often ask if there was an aha moment. Not sure if there was, but I did watch children. So I was a school leader on the Lower East Side when the Lower East Side was the Lower East Side and not the fancy East Village or whatever it's called now, 99% poverty level schools. Children would come. One of my responsibilities as a school leader was breakfast duty and lunch duty. Children would come in for breakfast with a bottle of soda and a bag of chips. You roll your eyes and you smirk, but they're still doing that. Just want you to know, unless they're in a Wellness in the School.
No,
of
but
course.
I know they still are. Yes.
So I watched that as a breakfast. They then went to a lunch, overly processed school lunch. Recess was then standing around doing nothing, particularly for the girls, or getting in fights and bullying. And I, you know, just sort of observed this. And we were young school leaders. I was under 30.
Well, what's a school leader?
I ran a small school. I was titled as an assistant principal. There was one principal who oversaw 8 schools.
Aye.
And I was one of her, I was her assistant principal. So I don't call myself a principal because I was
But it is public school you're talking.
Public school. Oh, yes.
New York
public
City
schools,
public school.
When they were doing sort of smaller schools.
Okay.
And I think there were maybe 200 kids in my school.
What was it, an elementary school?
A middle school.
Okay.
It was a co-located school. So there were many, many other schools in the building. It's a wonderful complex next to a big community garden.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, tough population and tough kids. The test scores here, it's like 0 to 4, mm-hmm. 0 being the lowest, 4 being the highest. Most of our kids would come to us in 6th grade with 0s and 1s. So it was our goal to really kind of get them higher. And again, at the time when I was working, I'd come to work and across the street there's a crack house and people were going home.
Yeah.
Now there's Hearth Restaurant on the corner, and which was the drug dealing deli mm-hmm. at the time. So,
yeah.
And we
huge
were,
gentrification.
Yeah, we were co-located in a high school. So mm-hmm. there were a lot of high school kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Anyway, so I would watch these kids come to school with the soda and the chips. It was usually orange. So not only did they have orange fingers and orange tongues for the rest of their day, but they could not focus in class. They could not walk a flight of stairs without stopping to catch their breath. They were visibly overweight, if not obese. Mm. You know, I didn't have markers and numbers. They couldn't focus. There was nothing about learning going on here. And we'd sit as young people in our staff meetings, and we'd talk about reading, writing, arithmetic, but we also talked about health, and they weren't even listening to us. So reading, writing, arithmetic did not matter. We would, again, we were young and had a lot of time and no kids of our own, and we would take them on hikes on the weekends, and we would do biking trips. We would do so much with these kids, thanks to, like, many other supporting organizations in the city. And they couldn't keep up with us, and we're just like, something is wrong with this. They need to be stronger and healthier than we were. So that was really the trigger, seeing these children and seeing their inability mm. to focus and to learn.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the mid-90s. And I kept teaching. And then early 2000s, I started having children of my own and was probably on maternity leave in a playground one day and was talking with other women and was like, you know what? It's time to do something about this. And that's when the idea really for Wellness in the School started.
What was it that you wanted to do?
Looking back, people are like, what a great idea. But at the time, I was like, I know schools. I know school lunch. In schools, you have a captive audience. I mean, yes, we could take on McDonald's and Burger King and all the drive-thrus and the regulations and the USDA. But here we have these schools with all these kids. So let's look at school lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew then, as I know now, that many schools, this is the one place that children have a healthy meal. Many children get more than 50% of their nutrition content from school. And so this is a great place to make change. Plus, you know, schools are an example for how to read, how to write, how
sure.
to behave. So why are we messaging to children that it's okay to be eating chicken fingers and French fries, right? And ketchup is a vegetable.
Right.
So I figured now pizza's a vegetable. So I just thought this is a good place. Let's make change in schools. So the beginning was completely guerrilla crazy. And I was now on my second child. I moved uptown. A good friend of mine from the Lower East Side, who's my principal, the mm-hmm. principal of the 8 schools.
Mm-hmm.
She became principal of a school on the Upper East Side called the Ella Baker School. And she ran a school that was 3-year-olds up through 8th grade. And she asked me to come and help her out. And I was like, oh, I'm having a baby. I don't want to do this. And I just need a little break. And then I came to the school and it was this beautiful breath of fresh air. And I was like, okay, I'll come help. So that school was really a place of practice and where it was a real testing ground. And
so that's where you kind of really gave
incubated.
Birth.
Yeah.
I was going to say, not only to a child, but to this
Correct.
To this project.
Yes.
Really kind of took form and shape there.
Yes. And mm-hmm. in Laura's office, now that we're talking about this, my newborn would sleep on the sofa. Mm-hmm. It was time for, I should either be in my Bjorn or on the sofa, depending on what I had to do. And we incubated a lot of these ideas, a lot of curriculum ideas. And then the same baby became 3, and she was in this class of 3-year-olds. It was my daughter and the principal's daughter and a couple other kids. Actually, the daughters of the 18-year-olds in the building, daughters and sons, would go to school there as well. Again, a very progressive building with the intention to keep parents, keep mothers in school, not to encourage them to have children. But
I understand.
If they were to have children, they could go to school.
Sure.
They had a baby program,
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
they had 3-year-olds. So they were all in this class together. And the teacher took them on a field trip to McDonald's. And I'm like, okay, we got to stop this right now. So I decided, I guess, with her, you know, she really wonderful, let me kind of do whatever I thought was right to do with these children. We decided to feed this one class. There were 16 children only, because that was the cap for 3-year-olds. And we said, we're gonna show them how to feed a healthy meal to children in schools. Meanwhile, you know, the Department of Education feeds 860,000 meals a day, and I'm going to show them how to feed 16.
Sure.
So I did. And we had the restaurant Candle Cafe. I don't know if you know, it's a all plant-based vegan restaurant on the Upper East Side. And another restaurant that's no longer here, it's called Slice Pizza. It was sort of the first pizza joint that did whole wheat crusts and the tomato sauce that had tons of vegetables mm-hmm. hidden in it and soy cheese as well as the regular cheese. So those two restaurants I think we actually paid. We said it cost $2.16 per child. Can you give it to us for that? So we paid them twice. So one would do Pizza Friday. One would come one day a week. That was 2 days. And then we had volunteer chefs working in makeshift kitchens to prepare homemade meals from scratch the other 3 days.
But you had to convince them to do that. I think you're kind of glossing over this. Well, the chefs to do this.
At the time, it wasn't so trendy, but we would put out
That's
like,
the whole point, that it wasn't so trendy.
Well, mind you, every 4 weeks, the chef would get a job, which I was very happy about. But then, you know, I'd be stuck again with trying to find a new chef. I remember April that year, because that's when I gave birth to my third child, I'm in the kitchen that was about as wide as my body and my belly trying to, you know, take out the baked fish fingers or chicken fingers and get it up to the kids. And there was a lot of this, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of like myself and other moms and teachers, you know, making it happen when we'd lose the chef because they got a good job. So I don't know if it was convincing. They all would come, but then they'd leave when they found a real job because
okay.
we weren't paying them.
Still, and you also wanted to make sure that everybody was on the same page when it came to what you were going
absolutely,
to eat.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know?
When I went on maternity leave, I will tell you, the menus were completely, you can imagine my analness. They were all completely written out with what we're having on this day and how to cook this. And if you run out, you can go to the frozen, but not to this. And, you know. So anyway, we got through that year.
With the three-year-olds. Who were a captive audience?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. We did take the milk from the cafeteria because they were still provided a school lunch.
Yes.
So we take fruit and we take milk to cut costs on
that. And then the rest?
The rest was, we collected, I think it was like $20 a parent for the year, for the month. I can't remember now. It's a long time ago. And we had a 501c3, so I may have had a couple donors help to just subsidize that. So that was the beginnings of the cafeteria piece. I'm sure we'll get to more about WITS, but there are many other educational components that go with it that we also practiced.
Uh-huh.
But the cafeteria piece was probably the most controversial. And, you know, because in the end, at the end of the school year, it's illegal is probably the wrong word, but to bring outside food to feed kids in a federally subsidized program was really not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the attention of all the people at the DOE, and that was the beginnings of WITS. I was so happy that they wanted to come see what we were doing, but they really wanted to tell us that we shouldn't be doing what we were doing.
But you, okay, so you nodded your head, but you plowed on. So give us the history of WITS.
So once we did get to know the professionals at the Department of Education, and our beginnings were not so, they were, I guess, somewhat auspicious, but in the end, they have now become our most important and our, you know, partner and our best advocate in terms of this work that we do, because they do feed 860,000 children every day. And we are their partner, one of many, to help improve this food and to help this food become healthier and continue to be healthy, to really meet the goals that they are trying to achieve, which, you know, is not easy when you've got all these kids and it's a federal program and you only have a little bit of money. So, you know, I hope that we're looked at as a great supporter in meeting their goals. But eventually, my kids were in another public school in the Upper West Side, which is where we lived. I stopped working at Ella Baker, and we started practicing again in three schools. And I, again, feel very fortunate to be able to use my children's schools as testing grounds. Wonderful.
Why not?
Mm-hmm. You know, wonderful principals who sort of trusted and had faith in this work. And it was always good to be working in my kids' school because I spent a lot of time there. Mm-hmm. And I could really see what was going on. So we started to roll out that program there, and I don't want to get too long-winded, but essentially what we ended up doing from the you know, idea of this class of 16 children, we began to get volunteer chefs come into the kitchen and to help prepare scratch-cooked meals. We created a new menu at the time. We called it the WITS menu. It's now the alternative menu, so it's much more sanctioned and done properly. At the time, we'd created these menus, and we were at PS 87. We decided let's promote these healthier menus to the parents at the parent-teacher conferences. So we came one night. We all came in. There was an amazing sort of diamond in the rough school lunch manager who let us come in her kitchen. We put on the hairnets. We made the chicken Caesar wraps. We made, you know, salads, and we had them all out for when the parents came in. And that's when Bill Telepan walked in with his wife for Leah's conference, for her...
His child's conference.
Yeah, it was their first or second grade. She's now in high school. Mm-hmm. And he came, he ran in, grabbed a sandwich, ran to the... Now that I know him, I'm chuckling because he's always late. He was late. He runs up to the meeting. He comes back down. He was walking out and he came up to me. He's like, who's in charge here? How can I help? And I always say to him, those four words really, really, really... created the Cook for Kids
Turned
program.
It around.
Yeah. Because we had no idea what we were doing. We were not. I'm an educator, and I do feel, coming from that background, I've been able to sort of feel very comfortable in schools and know people, and this person knows that one, and I know how to kind of walk in the
network.
School. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also just speak the language, because I get that question a lot. Like, how did you break the system in the schools?
For sure.
I'm like, that was easy. You know, that's what I did. But Bill really helped us to think through, like, what is this Cook for Kids program? I knew what I wanted to do. I knew we wanted to feed kids healthier meals from scratch in schools and make that an example for how we should live our lives. I knew I wanted to do that. I had no idea how I was going to get there. I had the vision, but wasn't exactly sure. And he really, really helped with that. And so when he came on board, we just started to create more menus and... We went from 3 schools to 8 schools the following year. We had 40 volunteers. So we had one volunteer chef every day in each school. So 8 schools, 5 days, 40 equals 40. And they would, you know, we had this great communication system, which I'm sure there's some app for now or some something for now, that they would email each other at night to their team of 5 to say what they did. I chopped the carrots, the salad bar's ready. We did a lot of work on the salad bars. Because mm-hmm. the hot meal still, it seemed like we couldn't, like, who are we to come in and tell them what to do and how to do it? So they would message each other every night so they knew who the person who came in knew what they would do the next day. And we learned from that first year. It was amazing, and we were all in there. But we did learn 2 sort of very important things, which was the consistency of labor. I mean, they were great, but to have someone in there every day would have been a lot more effective.
Could I still have peanut butter and jelly?
You could have peanut butter and jelly. You can still have peanut butter and jelly. It's often the alternative vegetarian meal. If they don't have a vegetarian meal. And there is actually one school in New York City that is peanut-free. Otherwise, you can get peanut butter and jelly in any school.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Nancy Easton, who happens to be the founder of the nonprofit called Wellness in the Schools. So would a child be likely to pick a vegetarian lunch over peanut butter and jelly and chips?
Now, the peanut butter and jelly is actually sort of the barometer for our failure, because if they don't take their hot meal that we have helped create and design, they're taking peanut butter and jelly as their backup. Most of the meals on our menu are vegetarian. Mm-hmm. We do have a chicken day.
But they're hot meals?
Hot meals. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Vegetarian chili made from scratch, pastas with homemade sauces. There's still Pizza Friday. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you our success or fail story about Pizza Friday. But hot meals, yes. Mm-hmm. And primarily from scratch, again, in partnership with the Department of Education. I'm fast forwarding. They've created an alternative menu for our schools, mm-hmm. and we're in 75 of their 1,200 schools, 75 of their, say, 400 elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And in those schools, they all use the alternative menu.
Do you go beyond elementary school?
We do. We're in a couple high schools.
Because that's harder.
We target elementary. There's some fun stuff happening in our high schools, but for the most part, we want to grab the kids when they're young. And so we target elementary schools. We love a K-8. We can go all the way through middle school with children.
So Cook for Kids turns into Wellness in the Schools because?
We always had Wellness in the Schools as our name. Have your wits about you. Cook for Kids is one of our programs. Mm-hmm. Coach for Kids is another, and Green for Kids is a third program. Mm-hmm. Cook for Kids is really the big sister. Mm-hmm. We're in the most schools with Cook for Kids. Most people know us through Cook for Kids. And then Coach for Kids is the younger sibling, but growing fast.
So explain to me where you are today and where you think you're going to be tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
So the 3 programs are not offshoots. They are Wellness in the Schools. Cook for Kids, Coach for Kids, and Green for Kids are our three programs.
That under the umbrella of Wellness in Schools.
Uh-huh. The Cook for Kids program centerpiece is the cafeteria, mm-hmm. with a very important component of Cook for Kids, which is our WITS labs. Again, as an educator, we don't go in and change the food in the cafeteria without teaching children why. Mm-hmm. So all of the recipes that they eat in the cafeteria can also be are also in a class. So they learn how to make a vegetarian chili. They say, this is delicious. And then we say, guess what? It's on your menu next Wednesday. So it's our best marketing tool. They love to cook. We have a whole setup where we can come in and cook. So that's the Cook for Kids program, with many other small components of it. WITS BITS, which are nutrition classes, parent teaching classes, parent cooking classes, teacher classes. But those two pieces are really the centerpiece. Then the Coach for Kids program is a program where we bring the coaches onto the recess yard. So the way my sort of elevator pitch is that we hire chefs, culinary school graduates, and we hire coaches or athletes or former athletes or coaches. We train them through our program, and then we place them in schools.
Wow.
And together they reinvent the school lunch experience. So healthier lunch, more positive recess experience, back to class, ready to focus and learn.
Wow.
With the long-term goal that we're teaching children in schools these skills and these habits for a lifetime of better health, so that we're ultimately fighting the childhood obesity epidemic.
And you see results.
We do see results. In the last 10 years that we've been doing this, we see so many anecdotal results. We have just entered, this is our first year, so now coming to the end of our first year, of an official evaluation with Teachers College, with Columbia University, and we're with their nutrition department, and we're very excited to see that these anecdotal results come into metrics. But we are, what we're seeing mostly is a culture shift in a school. We're not just seeing a different lunch and a different recess experience. We're seeing publishing parties, you know, teachers and parents wanting more regulations around publishing parties, so we're not just bringing in Dunkin' Donuts and Gatorade or, you know, soda.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing people think differently. We're seeing them want more fitness breaks during the school day. We're seeing them focus more on health and wellness, and that, and we're finally starting to see school leaders and educators and parents realizing how important health and wellness is to test scores.
You would just think
line,
that
you know?
On some level that it would be a no-brainer, and it's that this so stuff is so
not.
Glacially moved.
It's so not. Even the most progressive of principals will say to me, "Oh, but we can't do that because it takes away from learning time." And I just want to say, "Don't you see? It's not if the you know, it's not one or the other.
Right.
These things
it's not
go
a trade-off.
Together."
Yeah.
And there's a recent report on NPR from the schools in Finland have the highest test scores. They go outside every 45 minutes for fresh air and for running around.
Wow.
So I'm like circulating that to all of our – I'm still having to promote this to even the most progressive of principals.
But when you think about it, look at what you've done, you know, in the 10-plus years that you started this, that you went to 70 schools and, you know, thousands, 40,000 mm-hmm. students. Are you taking this on the road?
We are. Funny that you ask. We actually have piloted our program in two other states, in Kentucky and in Florida. And it was a pilot, I will say. And we are now really, I brought in actually a new staff member to really focus on this expansion, on this nationwide expansion. And what it'll look like nationally is probably not as deep of a dive, where we have these full-time people in a school every day, but we're creating toolkits so that we can train people who are already in schools, which I think will be just as impactful, because if you're in a school, you're living it and breathing it every
sure.
day. And I think almost even more impactful, because it can be even more part of the culture. So we're going to be training them here and sending them off and then providing webinars and support and visits and whatever else so they can continue on the program. It's a little bit, you know, away from our philosophy of like bringing in a professional chef and a professional coach, but we think it'll be strong in two ways. One, that it'll help us to expand faster, and two, and with less cost, frankly. But also, again, having this professional who lives and works in that school, and if they're going to be trained by us, they'll probably have buy-in and want to be part of this. So we're looking to do more training in
every
which way.
Is money an issue?
Money's always an issue.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm one of those naive people that thinks that if we grow, it'll come. And mm-hmm. we'll just keep growing.
Growing.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we do one or the other. The first year we went into 20 schools, I only had about enough money for 6. But we just kept going, and here we are. So, yeah, I mean, I should not sound so nonchalant. It's not easy to raise money, but we always continue to raise it to help support the program. So.
Well, you must be so proud of what you've been doing.
Yeah, but the goal is to be obsolete, but I don't think I ever will be.
I don't think
I'll
so
be old.
Either. Nothing wrong with being old. And, you know, and in this instance, yeah, it would be great to be obsolete because, you know, your work is done. But at
right.
least you just keep on keeping on. Nancy.
Right.
Yeah, keep on keeping
keep on,
on
I like
Nancy.
That.
It was really great meeting you.
You as well. Thank
well,
you.
We
that
ought to go
fun.
Out and have lunch sometime.
Absolutely.
Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. And if you have a guest that you would like to see interviewed on this program, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.